Good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Arno de Borgrave. I direct the Transnational Threats Project at CSIS. I guess my reason for being here today is that I've spent a lot of time in my journalistic career in South Asia. First covered the Chinese invasion of India in 1962, covered two of the three wars that India and Pakistan have fought. I've also covered the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and just before 9/11, I was in Afghanistan covering the Taliban regime. So think tanks, as you know, I'm sure better than I do, are by definition designed to open things up for deeper discussion about the critical issues of our time. And that's what we endeavored to do with the what is arguably the most important foreign policy challenge facing President Obama and his national security team. It's part Pakistan, part Afghanistan, and of course part Fatah. As Pakistan's ambassador to the United States, Hussein Haqqani, himself put it to the House Armed Services Committee, Pakistan continues to be a major center for Islamist militancy, radical Islamists who came from all over the Muslim world to fight against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, with powerful encouragement, of course, from the U.S. and Saudi Arabia throughout the 1980s. These same Islamists and their sons went on to become allies of Pakistan's military intelligence apparatus. Ambassador Haqqani added these Islamists were then used to fight Indian control over Kashmir, as well as to expand Pakistan's influence in Afghanistan. What we call extremists and what Pakistani intelligence sometimes regards as assets is part of the problem as the team assembled by CSIS takes a new and different look with granularity at the critical issue of Fatah, those seven tribal agencies under Pakistani sovereignty, which Pakistan has always had a hard time exercising, and which the Mumbai terrorist massacre makes even more critical. Now that India has turned over the evidence that the Mumbai terrorists were Pakistanis trained in Pakistan, Islamabad says it will bring those responsible to justice. But for those of you who follow that part of the world more closely, you know that things blew up again today. The National Security Advisor of Pakistan, Ambassador Durrani, was pushed out of office. Pakistan rejects the latest allegation from the Indian government that it was Pakistan at the government level that did Mumbai and so on and so forth, but it seems to have gained traction again as a crisis. Frequently overlooked by all sides is the impact of madrasas, the thousands of single-disciplined Quranic schools that produce plenty of potential volunteers for extremist actions, including suicide missions, but we forget that the CIA and Saudi intelligence encourage the notion of jihad training to mobilize resistance against the Red Army in Afghanistan. And at the outset, madrasas were established as an ideological barrier against the spread of communism from Afghanistan into Pakistan. And secret Saudi Wahhabi clergy funds continue to keep the madrasa culture alive to this very day. The future of Afghanistan, the future of NATO, the future or failure of President Obama's foreign policy, all are at stake in the acronym Fatah. General David Petraeus told me last summer a fresh look at Fatah was high on his list of priorities, hence this CSIS initiative, and I gave the new CENTCOM commander the very first unedited, unbound copy, without, of course, the charts and graphs and maps, over a month ago. This effort of ours was encouraged and funded by the Smith Richardson Foundation. The U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan received 70% of their supplies, including food and 40% of their fuel, overland from the port of Karachi, a 1,000-kilometer journey through the Khyber Pass, now the world's most vulnerable lifeline, subject, as you know, to frequent hit-and-run attacks by pro-Taliban raiders. There is little doubt in the intelligence community that al-Qaeda is plotting the next 9/11 somewhere in Fatah. Turkey, Germany, and the UK, just to name three countries, have tracked local national terrorist suspects to Fatah and back, presumably for training. This, of course, is not to say that Pakistan hasn't been a victim of terrorism. In fact, it has been one of its principal victims in the world and taken many casualties fighting it. Heading our CSIS task force on Fatah and the principal author of the report that you have today is Shuja Nawaz, a U.S.-based Pakistani scholar who recently published an international bestseller titled Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, which you can get through Amazon, Oxford University Press. Shuja is also a journalist who has reported for print and web and TV media and is much in demand as a speaker about Pakistan and the region on U.S. and Pakistani broadcast media and, of course, at think tanks. on both sides of the Atlantic. Shuja also had 30 years of experience as an international civil servant at the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and he was also a director at IAEA in Vienna. Next Monday, he becomes, and this is an exclusive announcement, he becomes the first director of the South Asian Center at the Atlantic Council here in Washington. Also on this panel this afternoon is Azi Hussein, Dr. Hussein, who was one of the five specialists who worked with Shuja on this effort. He's Vice President for Preventive Diplomacy at the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, acronym ICRD, here in Washington. Dr. Hussein currently heads ICRD's Pakistan Madrasa Project, which has trained more than 2,000 madrasa leaders in a campaign to take these out of the control of extremist mullahs, who teach, of course, as you know, that the United States is on a crusade to destroy Islam and that 9/11 was a plot by the CIA and Mossad to provide the pretext to do just that. Dr. Hussein was the recipient of the 2006 Peacemakers in Action Award by the Tannenbaum Center for Interreligious Understanding in New York. You will see in your report, pages 36 through 41, deal with what can be done near term, which means the next year or two, and medium term, or 3 to 5 years, by the government of Pakistan, the Pakistan military, the U.S. military, CENTCOM, and the government of Afghanistan. The costs of failure are, simply put, a victory for transnational terrorism and mission impossible in Afghanistan. As the report concludes, a nuclear Pakistan as a base for international terrorism is a prospect that the world cannot afford. But there are no quick solutions. Without the short-term action recommendations, the mid-term ones, let alone the long-term ones, become pie in the sky. So now I turn it over to Shuja. Thank you.
Thank you, Arno. I'm honored to present a very brief look at this fairly detailed report, which, as Arno has explained to you, was a joint effort of a number of persons who contributed to it over a very short period. Just to give you an idea, we began the project in July this year, last year, and with a lot of intensive meetings here, often meetings with people in different parts of the world communicating by audio conference, we managed to get the project going, produce some initial hypotheses and recommendations, and then with support from the CSIS, managed to go into the field and try and test some of those ideas by talking to key people in government as well as others in Fatah. So this is a joint effort. Although it carries my name as the principal author, I should acknowledge the contributions of the other participants. And although you have the monograph with you, just briefly, they included Maryam Abu Zahab, who is a scholar and who has spent 35 years as an expert on Fatah. She even speaks some Pashto, and she spends all her free time when she's not teaching at Sciences Po or any other place in Paris. She gets on the plane, leaves all her Western clothes behind, and dresses in the local garb, gets on the plane, and arrives there. And indeed, she spent a few months there recently. Azi Hussein has already been introduced. He was an extremely valuable resource because here is another person who's been in the field working within Afghanistan as well as in Fatah and in madrasas in Karachi, among other places, where he's trying to roll this huge rock up the hill, the rock of militancy. And then Aisha Jalal, who many of you probably know from her previous writings. She's a brilliant historian now at Tufts University, and her most recent book is Partisans of Allah, which is the story of jihad. And Aisha participated in this venture as an expert in the sense that she kept us on the straight and narrow. She would listen in on our discussions and ask all the tough questions. And then she would comment on the drafts. And then Kim Martin, who is from Barnard College, who's done a lot of work on conflict resolution and post-conflict situations, and who has recently developed an interest in Fatah, and so immediately immersed herself in such deep research that we felt that she was an extremely valuable member of the team. And then the youngest member of the team, a brilliant PhD candidate from SAIS, Johns Hopkins University, Josh White. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here either today. I would have wanted him to come and present some of his ideas, but a lot of his research and thinking is reflected in the report. And I want to thank all these team members for their efforts because the report is, as I said, a joint effort. Just very briefly, it was interesting for me to concentrate on this, not just as a Pakistani, but as somebody who's been following developments in Fatah for the last few years with a lot of dismay and unhappiness at what was happening, because to me it appeared that history appeared to be repeating itself, and that what successive governments going back 100-plus years have been doing in Fatah, we risk repeating unless we look to a new way of involving the people of Fatah and making them the primary source of information and guidance before we go in with our avowed mission of developing them and moving them away from whatever path we think that they are taking. I discovered, for instance, just in the last few weeks, that my own grandfather, who had served in the British Indian Army, had fought in two Waziristan campaigns. He fought in 1901 and in 1908, and he was wounded in 1908. He ended up then fighting in a place called Mesopotamia, which many of us now know as Iraq. And he was wounded in Iraq too. And then for his sins, I guess, he was sent to Belgium and he fought there. So there's a kind of a family connection because his son, my uncle, then fought in 1937, again, a Waziristan campaign, and was mentioned in dispatches. So these wars and these punitive expeditions are going to carry on unless we want to change the course of history. And this is why we felt it was important to look at Fatah and to come up with what we thought were practicable solutions, things that could be done that weren't 60,000 feet, that were at ground level, that with the right amount of political will, that some things could get started. As Arno said, our recommendations, which are short-term, could only work and lay the basis for the medium-term recommendations. But most important, we believe that unless you restore security to the region, and unless you provide that security from inside the region rather than from fortresses and from camps that are kept apart from the people of Fatah, that you are not going to be able to gain that traction and get them involved and get the ownership that you require for any project to work in Fatah. As we mentioned in the report, and I will go through this later in my introduction, there are examples of things that work. Even the much maligned U.S. aid effort has some very bright spots in it. The Office of Transition Initiatives has tested certain techniques for getting things done. The NAS, which is the Narcotics Assistance Section of the U.S. Embassy, has long experience in the area. And one of their lessons has also been that if you work with the people and they help you identify what their needs are, then you can give them the ownership and they'll help you succeed. So why is Fatah so critical now? As Arno was saying in his introduction, it's critical because it's not simply a sliver of land on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, but it's an issue that confronts the world, and it's an issue that confronts Afghanistan and Pakistan together. So you cannot look at it solely in terms of a Pakistani perspective. and then cross the border and take an Afghan perspective, because that border is porous and has always been. We found an old map that we put in the report. We've sort of dolled it up a little bit so that it's more readable. And even though that map is incomplete in some ways, because some of the tribes that we now know exist in each of the agencies are not mentioned there, like the Salarzai of Bajor, that map gives you an idea of just how discrete and self-contained these tribal and sub-tribal units are. And that's a very important element of dealing with Fatah, that you cannot find a silver bullet, you can't find a single solution that will allow you to find an answer to all the problems that we face in that region or emanating from that region. We're also looking at Fatah because the United States is concerned that the sort of petri dish for global terrorism resides in that area or on the outskirts of that area. And it's been very hard to pinpoint exactly where the Al-Qaeda people and Osama bin Laden are actually residing, but in all probability, they find the border equally porous and they probably are moving at will. And if you were to ask me, I would think that it's probably in the northern reaches that you might find them. But to go back to the basic point that we discovered in looking at past experience and what's happening now in Fatah, and that point I cannot stress and repeat enough, which is that you have to go to the people, find out what their needs are, and then try and get them involved in meeting those needs. That highfalutin programs and projects that are conceived in distant Washington or the capitals of Europe or in Tokyo will not do the trick. You really have to get them involved. Just a very brief history. Many of you, I know from the list that I've seen, already expert in the region. But one of the problems that has occurred in creating the conflict in Fatah is that it has always historically been treated as a buffer zone. So it didn't have an entity of its own. The British began this policy, and they insisted that there be a demarcation of the boundary, and so Sir Mortimer Durand went ahead and drew lines on the map. And when you see the map that we have of the ancient tribal boundaries, you'll find that he ended up dissecting some of the major tribal groups. For instance, the Momunds, who are a very major tribal group in Pakistan, are divided by the Durand line between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And as a result, they have never accepted the boundary. And Afghanistan did not actually allow the physical demarcation of that segment of the boundary. The other thing was that Fatah, when it was inherited by Pakistan in 1947, instead of amalgamating it or over time amalgamating it into the rest of Pakistan, it became a separate entity. It had its own legal system, which was the Frontier Crimes Regulations, which go back to the beginning of the 20th century. As a result, there was no sense of belonging and no sense of participation in the polity of Pakistan by the people that lived in Fatah. It's amazing that in spite of that, the people of Fatah continued to interact with Pakistan as if it was their own country. And in fact, as a very brief mention of some recruiting statistics into the Pakistan Army show, there's been an actual increase in the number of people who are being recruited for both soldiers and officer ranks in Fatah, and who are then retiring and going back to the Fatah. The other big problem was that from the get-go, the political participation of people of Fatah was taken away from them. They could only look after their own affairs inside Fatah. The Political Parties Act of Pakistan did not apply. So as a result, when you go there, you see the flags of various Pakistani political parties flying, but none of their officials, none of their leaders are allowed to go to Fatah and campaign or to run candidates on their tickets. So over time, when following General Ziaul-Haq's regime, when the mullah came to the forefront, you basically had an open space which the mullah then occupied, and he had a pulpit, and that became his political base. And no wonder that today religion is such an important part of the polity of Fatah. So this is another issue that obviously needs to be tackled. Another point that's worth remembering is that there was at some point an attempt made to settle Shia groups in what's now the Quram Agency. And so you have, in a small part of Fatah, a very active proxy war that has been going on for many years. And in this, the participation of both the Iranian and Saudi backers has often been mentioned. And what makes it really dangerous now is that the extreme right-wing Punjabi militant groups, some of whom are now being implicated in the Mumbai attacks, have actually moved into that area and are providing muscle for the rest of the Sunni groups there against the Shia. And so you've had an exodus of the Shia into Afghanistan, for instance. This is an extremely dangerous move because the people that have come are those that at one time were obviously being trained for the jihad in Kashmir, and so they are extremely sophisticated in their training. They can teach people on how to make bombs and use advanced weapon systems. So against this background, and in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, we thought that it would be important to lay out very briefly some of the perceptions and realities that are confronted when we look at Fatah. And it's worth talking about these because it's sometimes very difficult to separate perceptions from reality. And quite often, the perception ends up reinforcing reality. And so, therefore, these are, and I'll just go through these because they give a summary of the views of the team. First, the U.S. went into Afghanistan without a comprehensive plan for winning the war, beyond the immediate ouster of the Taliban. And the evidence for this is the fairly rapid shift of the United States forces from Afghanistan to Iraq. There was at that time no evidence of a comprehensive socioeconomic development plan or what would be a definition of victory in Afghanistan. The United States also failed to see the proactive need to help Pakistan transform its own army and the frontier corps into an effective counterinsurgency force. And this was done almost blindly by agreeing to a transfer of resources through the coalition support funds so that there was a bill and a reimbursement, and there was almost no discussion at the beginning of what the objectives were, what the benchmarks would be, and how would that be tested over time. And so as a result, the Pakistan Army has been in a kind of reactive mode ever since. Another perception or reality is that Afghanistan did not show a willingness to address the grievances of the Taliban against the excesses of the Northern Alliance in the wake of the U.S. invasion. Now, this has fed a very strong perception that persists to this day that somehow the U.S. move is an anti-Pashtun move or an anti-Pakhtun move. And therefore, till Afghanistan internally resolves this matter, this problem is likely to persist. Another powerful reality is this. The United States cannot win the war in Afghanistan without the full and willing participation and support of Pakistan, its army, as well as its general population. And unfortunately, as time goes by, the popular support in Pakistan for this war, which was seen as America's war, has been dwindling. Also, the United States cannot win by aligning itself with any single individual or party in Pakistan. And this was evident in the reliance on President and General Pervez Musharraf, who was all in all after 2001. Arno has already referred to another reality, which is that some 80% of cargo and 40% of the fuel that is consumed in Afghanistan by the coalition is supplied through Pakistan in these shipments that come from Karachi and then go across the border in Chaman at in Balochistan as well as in Torkham. The reality also is that Uzbekistan has expelled the United States and Russia has the ability to block flights over its territory, so the alternatives are very insignificant. There are reports of a road that is now being constructed with help from the Indian Frontier Works Organization, or the Border Works Organization, and that road goes through Iran to Chabahar. But then we face another immovable object, which is Iran, in terms of U.S. foreign policy. Another perception or reality, call it what you will, is that Pakistan, its army, and the ISI have had a very ambivalent position regarding the Afghan Taliban. And this was based on a very strong supposition that the United States would exit Afghanistan rapidly, as it once did after the exit of the Soviets from Afghanistan. And that this could also happen if they captured or killed some of the Taliban leadership and that the U.S. would declare victory and move on. And the other supposition was that Pakistan wanted some kind of a friendly or at least neutral government in Kabul, even if it was the Taliban. And because the Taliban are Pakhtun, and because most of Fatah is entirely, all of Fatah is Pakhtun, it was seen as a win-win situation for Pakistan if there was another Pakhtun government in Kabul. On its part, Afghanistan has some perceptions that it that informs its actions. And one of them is a fear that Pakistan wants to maintain control over Afghanistan as some kind of a client state. The fact that it is a landlocked economy makes it harder for Afghanistan to be independent of Pakistan in that regard. And another powerful and persistent perception within Pakistan, which informs the situation in Fatah, is that rival India has chosen to develop both civil and military ties with Afghanistan, and it is alleged that it even helps fuel some of the militancy in Pakistan. So many Pakistanis, when you talk to people on the street, still see some kind of a massive international conspiracy to encircle and weaken and destroy Pakistan. And many of them repeatedly point to this famous map that Mr. Peters produced about the new Middle East, with bits of Pakistan floating off into other neighboring countries. Yet we have to recognize that neither capitulation nor confrontation by Pakistan with U.S. interests in Afghanistan and in Fatah is the right approach. Rather, engagement and a joint effort to eliminate the militancies inside Afghanistan and Pakistan is the best approach. And how to go about it? Pakistan has committed the equivalent of 6 divisions to Fatah and to a Northwest Frontier Province against the militancy. These are the 6 divisions that formed part of Pakistan's strike force against India if ever there was to be a conflict. And so the Pakistan Army is very nervous about this very vulnerable area where they've now removed the infantry from the Indian border and the infantry is sitting on the Afghan border. But the reality is also that the Pakistan Army is predominantly, as the share of population of the various provinces indicates, 60% a Punjabi army. And so there are only something like 14.6% Pakhtuns in the Pakistan Army. And so when they go into Fatah, and they go especially outside the built-up areas where some people do speak Urdu, they are totally an alien force. And that's how they're also regarded by the people in the countryside. So it's a very difficult kind of situation. The reality also is that Pakistan is fighting a counterinsurgency and a militancy inside its own borders. So it has to be very cognizant of the damage, collateral damage, particularly to civilians, which will have a huge backlash, not just in Fatah, but in the rest of the country. Another reality which has emerged over the last few years is that the traditional system of governance that was used in Fatah, that was inherited from the British, involved a government representative, a political agent, who was supposed to know all the tribal leaders and who would selectively appoint maliks, who would then receive largesse from the government and deal with them, and then they were responsible for keeping law and order within their areas. But the sad thing of this system of government was that there was tribal responsibility for any wrongdoing. So if I belonged to the Dawar tribe in North Waziristan and something happened in my area and I was the head malik, I would be called in and thrown into jail, and my family would be thrown into jail, and I would be told to go and produce the crooks, and because the whole tribe is responsible. And all our privileges and all our payments would be stopped. So this is a very crude colonial system that was inherited by Pakistan and maintained by it. Well, over time, with the change in demographics, the porosity of the border, the movement of the Pakhtun population from Fatah to other parts of Pakistan, particularly to Karachi and the Gulf, you had an opening of the minds of people in Fatah. And so this old system no longer works. What made it even less effective was that we had a number of successive governors of the Northwest Frontier Province under General Musharraf, who were ex-army people, who even though they were Pakhtuns themselves, decided that the old system of beating the Pakhtuns over their heads till they begged for forgiveness and then giving them money was the best way of ruling them. And so when they went in after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and tried to help clear the border, they ended up alienating the Maliks, they ended up alienating and the political administrators. And when these power centers disappeared, guess who was around to pick up the pieces and take charge? It was the mullah again. I won't go into great detail about the role and the emergence of the mullah because I've mentioned it a few times, and you will see in the report itself how over time there was a sociological transformation of tribal society and how the mullah, who used to be a peripheral actor, came into the center of the tribal decision-making. So I'm going to skip over that. We've also heard repeatedly from the many excellent other reports that have been done on Fatah and on Pakistan recently by think tanks in Washington, of the disparity in the socioeconomic indicators. So suffice it to say that when you have female literacy of 3% in Fatah, and if the socioeconomic indicators in Pakistan are here, in the Northwest Frontier Province they're here, and in Fatah they're over here, there is a massive disequilibrium in opportunity for those people. And why would they feel part of Pakistan and feel in ownership for Pakistan? Before I go into a very brief introduction of some of the key suggestions that we made, I think at this point I would like to ask Azi if he could talk a little bit about the work that he has done and that he contributed to our effort on the madrasa reform, because that's an issue that is quite critical to how we proceed on Fatah. So, Azi.
Can you all hear me? I know after lunch there is a food coma happening here, so I'll try to make it exciting. Madrasas are probably, most of you all know, are religious institutions. They provide room and boarding for and food for students, largely poor students in Pakistan. And it's an eight-year program. It's called Dars-e-Nizami curriculum. Emphasis is on religious teaching, The first part of it is Hifz, which is memorization of Quran. And after that, they can learn about the Prophet's life, the philosophy of Islam. And most of these madrasas are, nobody knows how many, but about 20 to 25,000 of these seminaries that are full-time in Pakistan. Some of them are very big, almost like a university setup, have up to 7 to 8,000 students that live there. So it's a pretty big enterprise. Madrasas are also important because they create imams or clerics for Pakistani society. And as you can imagine, you can create an engineer or a doctor, but when you have an imam who speaks to a few thousand people every week, advises lots of people, the reach and influence of the message of a cleric is huge. So madrasas, though might be small in compared to the numbers of public school system, but have, in fact, more of an impact in a Pakistani society. If you multiply the influence of each cleric who is getting out of these schools, again, I think Shuja already talked about perceptions, and I think perceptions are real in their consequences because most of it is perception on both sides as well in America as well and West. And when a madrasa, especially religious leaders, perceive that United States is out there to destroy the identity of Islam. And they are there to protect the identity of Islam. Of course, you are fighting an intractable battle. And it is intractable in such a acute way that unless these issues are resolved and some of the tones are not changed, I think those perceptions will persist. just to wake you up a little bit more, I think especially when I'm talking to Tariq-e-Taliban commander in Northwest Frontier Province, especially in Fatah area, he says, thank God, you really shown your colors. And you mean Americans, he thinks of me as an American. He's gone through our workshop, and he said, we had such a hard time for the last 2-3 years recruiting people to fight the Westerners. And as soon as the predators strike in a madrasa in Northwest Frontier, Fatah area, we have hundreds, literally, of recruits willing to fight. So no simple solutions here. And I think it's very, very complicated to think that a force or military or even engagement can all solve the problem. I think there's multiple levels of engagement, and we have to think very hard. So there is... madrasas are quite influential in Pakistan, in Fatah area especially, but there are those perceptions that somehow United States or West especially is after them, after Islam or their identity, exasperate the issue of engagement with madrasas. And then United Pakistani government, being ally of United States, then serves the similar role in building trust with madrasas, saying the Pakistani government is also out there to destroy who we are. And then on top of that, then policymakers in Pakistan as well, and the government, when the reports come to United States, has... all to do with developing the country, which is the government's job, but very little to do with developing the religious part of it. And madrasa and religious leaders feel that they are being sidelined and isolated. So all these perceptions kind of create so this sense of victim mentality, sense of mentality that they are being oppressed from all these different sides. And, of course, that creates much more isolation, and they insulate themselves even further. So level of exposure is very very little, and conspiracy theories go sky high. In madrasa, you hear things. I've been training madrasa leaders and teachers for the last 5 years, about 2,500 been trained our program, and so many of them are asking us to do more of their training on pedagogy, teacher development, and peace and tolerance. Which is surprising to most of the Western folks, because it's perceived as they are so resistant to change or to teach contemporary courses, especially English, math, and sciences. But when you engage them with a sense of respect, you kind of create an equilibrium with integrity. There is a way to address some of these conflicts, and I think. One of the major issues with religious leaders in Pakistan, especially madrasas, is that they constantly talk about a very autocratic government. It's oppressive, and it's unjust, and that it oppresses its people. It does not provide the development opportunities. The poverty is going up. So these are the major pieces which all of us probably would agree with, right? And this is the religious line. So I think not using madrasas or religious leaders for development activities, when they are embedded within the community, becomes even more, it looks like a total conspiracy theory, because all of our development aid goes to Pakistan, and Pakistan says, don't give it to madrasa. The heightened sense of fear even goes up even more. I do think that there's got to be a way to find, because in Fatah area where the development is acutely needed, madrasas already have an infrastructure, poor, but there is an infrastructure. Each madrasa has some sort of a clinic. You can offer a lot to the communities there. And since they talk about justice and injustices, there could be courses. And I've talked to Fatah madrasas many times where they would take a course on justice, how to create, even on a secular a sense, how to create a small kind of a clinics to provide people their rights, legal rights. And I think so these are all very healthy activities that one can involve religious leaders and madrasas especially, because those will only enhance the capacity of the government to provide the services to the community in Fatah, which is so needed. There's lots of recommendations here, and I'll go through it very, very quickly. Do I have to? You can go through the recommendations. Okay. But I think my line of argument is very similar to Shuja's, which is thoughtful, careful engagement of religious leaders and religious institutions by Western or Western organizations in a safe way, and also Pakistani government especially, I think would result in a positive social change.
Thank you, Azi. And Azi's detailed suggestions are in the report, and I'll be mentioning some of them. Just 2 points before I get to our major recommendations. One, that there's some kind of a notion, a quaint notion, that the tribal areas and therefore Fatah are different, and that the people are different and their needs are different. When you actually sit down and talk with them, you discover that they are no different from people in the United States or in the rest of Pakistan, or in Iraq, or in Afghanistan. The basic needs that they talk about, and this emerged in a conversation I had with 23 tribal maliks representing the Wazir and the Dawar tribes in North Waziristan, are irrigation. They want help with their systems. They want basic education so their kids can go and compete in the world outside. They want primary health care. And they want access to hospitals in the area so that they don't have to cart their sick long distances into the settled area where they will only do when the people are on their deathbed. And so there's a very bad association between going to a hospital, because you never recover, you die. And education, which is critical for them. They feel that they want their girls educated, and they want full-time teachers rather than ghost teachers in the area. So that's something to keep in mind. The other point worth mentioning is we mentioned the inability of the Pakistan Army to fight a counterinsurgency. This has been a very difficult transition for an army that was poised always to deal with India in a conventional war, for an army that introduced mountain warfare and a school in Ratu at 16,000 feet, but only because that could be used in Kashmir. But that over time, in fact, stopped teaching a separate course called Frontier Warfare, which the British introduced, which was all based on Waziristan and that area. And so they're now gradually coming back to that, and there's a kind of relearning of the process. But the doctrinal shifts haven't taken place in the army. It's still an army that lacks the tools to do the job. They don't have helicopters, and you need mobility. And the United States promised them 27 helicopters, and not all have been delivered. They're still being refurbished. And when you look at that vast area, an arc going from the south Waziristan all the way up to Deer and Bajor, it's, how can you deal with a very mobile militant force which is using pickup trucks to move in and out and attack isolated posts and disappear? So there is a serious issue there that needs to be addressed. Against this background, we came up with the proposals of what can be done. And I'm not going to go through the entire list, but I just want to highlight a few. So for the government of Pakistan, we've suggested that it must openly discuss and agree in Parliament on the status of Fatah. This is something that has been pushed under the carpet. It needs to discuss its relationship with the NWFP government, and it needs to discuss the relationship between Fatah and NWFP and the central government. You have to involve the local people in this situation so that you don't have a dual border situation where you have one border with Afghanistan and another border with Fatah. So if you integrate Fatah into Pakistan proper, you're likely to get the same kind of reaction and participation from the people of Fatah that you got from the NWFP when it joined Pakistan in 1947. So an end to treatment of Fatah as a buffer zone. That's the basic point. Amend or then displace and replace the Frontier Crimes Regulation so that you can provide justice, which is the point that Azi was making. Everybody wants justice and they want it rapidly. And the Taliban provide rapid justice. So how do you displace them? You have to replace the FCR. Also, extend the Political Parties Act to Fatah so that they feel that they belong to Pakistan and they participate in the politics of Pakistan. For the Pakistan military, we've suggested strengthening the ability and the role of the Frontier Corps to provide security to the local population from within the population, to put an end to the idea of sitting in camps. And you find this tremendous disparity. You go there and there's load shedding, so there's no electricity. But the military camp is all lit up because they have generators, and the rest of the population doesn't have electricity. It creates tensions and conflict between the military and the locals. We've suggested something very specific, which is that because of the hiring of people from Fatah and from the Northwest Frontier Province over the years into the military, you have a pool of retired FC and Pakistan Army people living in Fatah. And if you were to only rehire them and make them part of the development effort and security efforts locally, it would be a much less expensive way than having to use large bodies of trained armor and artillery and so on. And they would be people living within the community, so they would be much more effective. We've also suggested an intensification of training in counterinsurgency. And I was very pleased in August when I went, I got a detailed briefing from General Pasha, who is now the head of the ISI, who was then head of military operations, about an actual program that the Pakistan Army now has for inducting troops into this fight so that they go through an indoctrination and training, ending up with a live fire exercise so that they know exactly what to expect. This is what the British used to do, and that stopped happening over time. We've also suggested establishing closer cooperation with the Afghan forces and the coalition forces across the Durand Line. And we're pleased to report that the latest news indicates that the defunct Tripartite Commission has now actually been revived and is meeting regularly, alternating between Kabul and Rawalpindi. And General Kiani himself has made that a special effort on his part. We've also suggested that the United States help train the Pakistan Army in producing civil affairs officers, because there is no such training or ability within the Pakistan Army today. They have a few people who deal with PR, but I ran into one colonel who had been 2 years in Fatah, and I asked him in Pashto, I said, "Do you speak Pashto?" And he said, "No." Well, that was basically the end of my Pashto, but he didn't even have that. So you need to have that capacity and be able to converse. For the U.S. government, for the near term, we are suggesting a definition of an exit strategy for Afghanistan. What is it that will mean victory for whatever aims you want to set for Afghanistan? And to accelerate a very targeted economic development of Pakistan as a whole, because you need to win all of Pakistan's support, the NWFP, and of course Fatah. The NWFP is critical because the stain of militancy has now crept across the border with Fatah into the settled areas, and that's now threatening the heartland. We've also suggested that the CENTCOM commander somehow convince his lawyers in Washington to redefine the theater of war so that Fatah becomes part of that theater, which would allow the CENTCOM to use the commander's emergency relief funds in conjunction with the Pakistan Army, which appears to be willing to use these and get the cash directly into the hands of the people. We have to recall that this is a cash economy, that the projects that we now come up with in Washington start leaking at a very rapid rate in Washington, then in Islamabad, and then in Peshawar. By the time you get to the ground, there's very little money getting into the hands of the people. So this way, you're in there, you make people responsible, give them the money, go back, review what they've done, and then give them some more money. That's the fastest way of getting them on your side, in our view. We also suggest rebuilding the trust because of this enormous trust deficit between the U.S. military and Pakistan. And that can only happen by bringing particularly younger and medium-level officers together, Afghan and Pakistan and the U.S. There was an attempt made to bring colonels from the Pakistan Army to the NDU to interact with the Afghans in Washington. The first attempt failed miserably because, for some reason, one of the seven agencies that clears visas refused to give a visa to any of the Pakistani colonels, and so they couldn't come. Now, there may be third country options available too, but this needs to be done at a very rapid click. And then for the government of Afghanistan, we are suggesting coordinating with Pakistan and building infrastructure inside Afghanistan and in Fatah so that you have roads and that roads lead to open economies and create their own job opportunities for people. We're also suggesting providing cash crop alternatives to opium. And there are proposals afoot from people that know more about it than we do about buying opium even for medicinal purposes for pharmaceutical industry. And we are suggesting, as I mentioned earlier, joint training programs between the Pakistan and Afghan forces. And one idea that emerged was that the U.S. is trying to rebuild the Afghan Air Force. And the Pakistan Air Force has had a long experience in building air forces of other smaller countries in the region, particularly in the Gulf. So that may be a good opportunity to get into that. Briefly on the madrasas, it's not just a short term but a medium term effort, as Azi was saying. You need to set up and register training centers inside Fatah so that they operate under civilian control. That's quite critical. You need to regulate the madrasas so that they're accredited and they're affiliated with the regular education boards in the rest of Pakistan. And you also need to introduce vocational training in the public schools because work opportunities in the Gulf are drying up. You now have about 4 million Pakhtuns living in Karachi, sizable population, in fact, more than live in Fatah. And the ability of Karachi to absorb more immigrants from Fatah is very limited. So you need to focus on preparing them using whatever is on the ground, including the madrasas, transforming the madrasas into a force for the good rather than one that you view with suspicion. I'm going to stop here, and I'm sorry I took so long. We'll have time for questions, and hopefully Azi and I and Arno will be able to answer your questions. Thank you very much.
I saw a lady with her hand up. Yes, ma'am. I think the microphone is right next to you. Yes. Could you identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Narjis Ali, and I was born and grew up in Pakistan. So I have an observation. The word madrasa comes from the word daras, which means lesson, and madrasa really means school. That's the literal translation. And I think the implied meaning of madrasa being a religious school is sort of destroying that whole culture in Pakistan. And I feel that madrasa was a word that we always used as a translation for school. So why cannot the public school system be integrated once you have your training and everything set up in the madrasas that exist today, which I want to call dini madrasas and not just madrasa? So why would we not call all public schools that are probably Urdu medium madrasas? And they would have all kinds of education, not just religious education.
I think you're right. Madrasa in Arabic, madrasa means schools, so it does not automatically mean it's a religious school. So dini madrasa means religious school. So, to name public school as well, madrasa just probably would not fly, just because the society has grown out of it. The nomenclature and the name itself has so much significant symbolic meanings behind it that many people would have problem going to madrasa that in fact is a public school, which is public schools are run by government. Madrasas do not take any money from the government. So I think I'm not sure how one would do that.
But surely is also the problem of the fact that the government cannot afford public schools, as most of the money goes into the military, hence the growth of the madrasas, which are free.
Absolutely. I think that's a huge problem.
Yes, sir. Microphone right behind you.
Oh, thank you. This is a terrific effort using social sciences, socio-political, and economic approaches to understanding this. Although it wasn't covered in the report, to what degree is the acquisition and distribution and sources of weapons, guns, bombs, and so forth, a factor in this? And I realize that's a different form of information than what you've been covering, but how much of a factor might that be?
Surely everybody in that part of the world is born with a gun in its cradle.
That's correct, and also, as many of us have now seen, because almost all foreign journalists make the obligatory stop in Dara Adam Khail, where they can reproduce any weapon in the world. It may not be as effective, but it certainly looks like any weapon in the world. So, yes, weapons are a part of Fatah, and this is also one of those rules where, because Fatah is treated as a buffer zone, they are allowed to carry their weapons without any let or hindrance, whereas in the rest of Pakistan, you need a license. Now, in terms of the supply of weapons, I guess that was where you were headed. That, unfortunately, was not a topic that we covered. When I went to Swat and Malakand and saw some of the captured weapons as well as the chemicals, it was quite evident that they were coming from all over the world. I mean, the chemicals that were being used to create bombs, for instance, had factory markings from Germany. And so there is clearly an international market which is very effective. And because the borders are porous and because you can get them through the Gulf and through other locations, the supply of weapons is something that has been unabated. Another point that is worth remembering is that there were a lot of weapons left over after the Soviet war. There were weapons that were left in caves that the Taliban were directed to by the ISI when they began their move. And so a lot of those weapons are still in existence and in circulation. Some are pretty ancient, but they still work. And landmines are in plentiful supply, and it doesn't cost a lot for the Taliban to get young kids to go and dig up these mines and then use them for IEDs and other devices.
Yes, sir.
My name is Walter Anderson. I'm from SAIS. I'm Josh Weiss, dissertation advisor.
Could you speak up?
I'm Josh Weiss's, White's dissertation advisor. My question is actually directed to Shuja. In your report, you mentioned that the collapse of the Moloch traditional authority has opened up the space for resistance, and much of the resistance is non-Mullah oriented, but yet they've identified themselves with religious Talib symbolism. Why has this happened, and can you turn it around, or is it, you know, a thing we should strive for to turn this effort of identifying yourself with a kind of religious symbolism, turn it around to something else, Pashto nationalism, something?
Actually, Walter, and for those who didn't hear him, Walter is the dissertation advisor to Josh White, our brilliant scholar and partner in this effort. It's multi-layered. It's not just a simple question of, you know, religion versus some secular approach. The Tehreek-e-Taliban of Pakistan uses religion, but the Tehreek-e-Taliban also has franchise arrangements with many different groups throughout Fatah, and they vary from agency to agency, and some of these groups are just pure criminals, as we identify them in our report, and they're just using the name of religion as a way of aligning themselves with this broad movement that transcends tribal boundaries. So, yes, there is a political significance to it. They want self-governance, they want rapid justice, and they want to be able to call the shots themselves. And the Tehreek-e-Taliban is appealing to all of that, and where it can, it'll use religion to help it. And as Azi mentioned, and in the report we mention a quote from Baitullah Masood, the founder of the Tehreek-e-Taliban, that it was the predator strikes that really helped him recruit people.
Yes, sir. Could you identify yourself?
Yes. Thank you. Paolo von Schirach, Schirach Report. I was actually very interested in the comments that you had made before about back on the subject of the madrasas. There is this sort of simplified, caricaturesque view portrayed also, you know, by commentary and media in the West, that these are sort of the factories of radicalism, and there's really, you know, this conveyor belt that spews up, you know, other fanatics, suicide bombers, et cetera, and there's basically nothing we can do about it, short of spraying them with DDT and killing everybody. The picture that you are portraying is very different, is much and much more nuanced in terms of the ability and the opportunity to engage the management, so to speak, the faculty of these schools. I'm surprised that if this is indeed so and your efforts are underway, that this is not something that is not more, you know, earnestly pursued, as this may be the way to defuse the bomb of further recruitment, in other words, which is the weapon of Islamic radicalism or any other type of radicalism to find new people. To the extent that your efforts seem to be reasonably successful, why is it that this is not more publicized and that not more is done in terms of engaging the faculty and direction of these schools? Thank you.
Could you hand the mic to the person behind you? Thank you.
I think we are successful in that we get the engagement, and we get a lot of requests from madrasas to say, we like your training, we'd like you to come and give us kind of a roadmap as how to reform our own madrasas. So those are very, very, very good things. And not all madrasas are obviously not radical. There are some very excellent madrasas there. And I think many people do notice our effort. We avoid media like anything, obviously, because But of course, you know, it could say a very good thing about us, and it can also say a few things about Madrasa, and then Madrasa won't talk to me because something derogatory has been said by them. So that is a difficult thing in getting the exposure that we need in a safe way as well. So I think those are some technical difficulties, but I do think as a my boss call it asymmetrical war. I don't like that word, but anyway, but that is probably is the most effective way to fight radicalization, if you will, and especially in those areas, in border areas. If you look at the border area from all the way from Fatah all the way to Pashin and Chaman, Balochistan, all of those provinces next to it in Afghanistan are on fire. I mean, that's where most of the fight is going on. So there's a lot of correlation between those two areas, madrasas and all of that. So, I think people should take it more seriously.
I think we also tend to forget that from 60 to 100,000 young boys come out of these madrasas every year, and I would guarantee that 99% of them believe that America is the enemy and that we're out to destroy Islam, and that 9/11 was a Mossad CIA plot. So that's moving, as I think you said before, Azi, moving a huge boulder up the hill. Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Nawaz, you talked about improving the trust between Pakistani Army and U.S. Army. My question is about the trust between Mr. 10% and Pakistani Army. He comes here and calls Kashmiri terrorist. He tells Bush that the world is a better place because of Bush, that most even American would laugh at his statement. So how can we take care of these problems unless we address these kind of very fundamental issue of having corrupt people ruling that country? I mean, probably he is in the making of few billion dollars and then leaving Pakistan. Can we address these problems really without solving this corruption problem in that country? Thanks.
This is beyond the scope of the paper, but I will give you an answer. I will give you an answer because you deserve an answer and the people of Pakistan deserve an answer. I think the solution really is an ability of engaging the people of Pakistan in whatever decisions are made. So when you have decisions, particularly policy decisions that are made behind closed doors, whether it involves an alliance with the United States after 9/11 by General Pervez Musharraf, or whether it involves any relationship between the current government and the U.S. government, if it is not discussed openly, then you lose the trust of the people. And so the most important thing for Pakistan and for its polity, and particularly for the new civilian government, is to build that trust of the people of Pakistan, that the government is there to serve them and not the other way around. And once you do that, you will have the possibility of a longevity of civilian rule. And you may be able to build on the public statement of the current army chief that he wants to keep the army out of politics. But, you know, I wrote a whole book on this topic. We've heard that tune before, and that tune can change very rapidly if the situation deteriorates. So the effort must be on the part of the friends of Pakistan as well as the people within Pakistan to try and have an as open a discussion of these issues. Talk about Fatah, talk about India, talk about Kashmir, and talk about the relationship with the U.S. so that there are no secret agreements and there's no wink or a nod.
Yes, sir. Okay.
John Keaton. Earlier today, I skimmed all 400 or 500 pages of the Corot book, The Pathans, 5,000 Years of History, looking for a few pregnant sentences that we all should have learned before we went in there. But he has a chapter called Pathan Pashtun Renaissance. And we, of course, are dealing with the security issues, the development issues. But is not there evidence that at the same time these difficulties are overtaking us, that there is a cultural renaissance going on among the Pashtun people that will become a factor as we look into the future? The poetry, the music, the culture, their identification. Are those factors developing positively for the Pashtuns?
Well, Karo's book was written a few decades ago, and at that time, because it was so soon after independence, there wasn't any threat emerging from Fatah. But he's right, and you're right, and when you go to Pakistan today, and I'm not just talking of Fatah alone, in the Northwest Frontier Province as well as in the rest of Pakistan, there are lots of things that happen in spite of government. It is probably one of the most active music and art scene in that part of the world. There was a very fascinating review article by William Dalrymple recently on fiction emerging out of Pakistan. The title was Fiction from a Jihadi State. His conclusion was that there's probably much better fiction coming out of Pakistan today than out of India, which has much larger numbers of writers in English in particular. So, yes, this is happening largely because of technology and because the world is now available to even the poorest man with a transistor radio in Fatah. And those are the mechanisms that we have to use to bring those people back on board and to empower them with knowledge and information. So, yes, the Renaissance is there. It's in all the arts and cultures. But if we lose the security battle and don't provide for economic and social development in Fatah, then the Taliban will come in and switch off the DVDs and the VCRs and the radios and the televisions. And then you'll be back to the dark ages.
David, we have some in the front row here, our guest from the British House of Commons.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and delighted to hear your thoughts. Looking at the recommendations, I noticed that it's very much US-centric and to do with Pakistan, of course. You mentioned the Durrand line, which just gives a hint of the British Foreign Secretary who was responsible for creating that line, and indeed the legacy that the British have had in involvement in Pakistan. Is there anything, is it now too late for the British themselves, which have a long history of involvement with the area, to use their influence, or is this very much now a US issue?
Well, you're right, Tobias. The British did bequeath a legacy, drawing lines on both sides of Pakistan that reverberate in history. So the lines on the border with India and Kashmir, and then also the Durrand line, which is drawn much, much earlier. Of course, Britain has an important role as part of the Western community, and also because the British Army, if Britain were to commit more of its meager forces to the area, would probably help the U.S. effort inside Afghanistan, because they have not just a tradition but great knowledge of how to interact with the locals, as was proven in the Basra area in Iraq by actually being in the population. But I think in the end, it's money that talks, and the United States has the largest pot of money available. And you really, if you're going to change things dramatically, you have to make that economic impact very quickly so that people can see what the counterfactual to the current situation is. That if you can give them the cash, empower them to use that cash for their own good. So to the extent that Britain can join that effort, it certainly has the knowledge, and I would certainly support that.
Yes, sir. At the back.
Peter Kuharis, a lawyer and in a former life a relief and development worker in Asia and Africa. I very much find compelling your analysis about the socioeconomic development and empowering local people and really looking to them for what initiatives to be taken. But I've read a lot about the insecurity in the region and the traditional government structures, whether it was the Maliks or others, even the army being embarrassed, and the traditional social structures, tribal structures being attacked and undermined specifically because they were a threat to the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda, much the way Al-Qaeda targeted tribal leadership in the south of Iraq versus in Anbar, where they didn't do that, and the British had a difficult time of it in the south. I wonder to what extent do you... What can we do about that? the lack of security, the targeting of people who appear to be working with the government, to be working against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, because it's awfully difficult, as you know, to develop and start some of the programs you advocate if the security situation won't permit it. And let's face it, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda aren't foolish. They understand that it's a threat to them.
I think I mentioned one specific recommendation that we had, which was to change the approach to providing security so that it's community-based by putting the retired FC and Pakistan Army veterans from Fatah and making them responsible for security within their communities, as well as security of development workers who are doing rebuilding and reconstruction work. But there's another aspect to it which has been highlighted by the recent operation in Bajor, where the local tribes themselves took on the job of policing as an adjunct to the Frontier Corps. The only danger in that is that because of intertribal rivalries, when you end up arming one group with more sophisticated weapons than the other, then you risk the problem of an imbalance in that military power once you exit. And then if that particular tribe decides to turn against you, you'll have a much more implacable foe. So you really have to begin at the community level and have a presence that is seen by the locals so that they can then trust the security forces to protect them and not leave them at the mercy of the Taliban, because the forces come on a patrol and then go back to their fortress. And then the Taliban come in and basically, using threats and coercion, cower the people down.
We have time for three more. There's a gentleman right here, the lady at the back, and you, sir, in the front.
Thank you, sir. I think, Mr. Nawaz, you underestimate or underemphasize the role of the central government or central authority in the tribes in the Fatah region. In fact, the system of paying maliks was started by Shah Jahan so that he could withdraw the forces and concentrate the monies on building Taj Mahal and the city of Shah Jahanabad. So the system goes back for 340 years. And in 1948, there were six Pakistan Army brigades in the Fatah region, all of whom were withdrawn with the support of the tribals to wage war in Kashmir. So there is a much more tighter relationship. I'd like your comments on that. Thank you.
Yes, the brigades that you refer to were withdrawn under rather interestingly named Operation Curzon, which goes back to an earlier historical reference of the British aims in Central Asia. There were two reasons. One, of course, was to show the people of Fatah that Pakistan was not a colonial force, and therefore, instead of having the garrisons in Wana and other places, that there would only be the locals, the Frontier Corps, the levies, all the locally recruited people providing security. The other one, I think you overestimate the numbers of people that came from all the Fatah region into the Kashmir War. There was a total number of about 5,000 odd tribal Lashkar that went into Kashmir that came from all over the Northwest Frontier Province as well as Fatah. So it wasn't Fatah-centric. Yes, the central government has a role, but I believe, and a lot of people in Pakistan believe, that the relationship between the center and the periphery in Pakistan needs to be readjusted, because the government of Pakistan cannot control everything from the center, and the only way of bringing Balochistan and the Northwest Frontier Province and Fatah and Sindh to feel that they're part of the federation is by giving them much more authority to manage their own affairs.
Lady at the back.
Bridget Huston, U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. You mentioned the Quram Agency and the ongoing Shia-Sunni conflict in your remarks, and I didn't see that issue addressed specifically in any of the recommendations. So what recommendations do you have for the Pakistani government with respect to that ongoing conflict, as well as the populations of internally displaced people who are from Quram Agency?
Well, my recommendation would be, first of all, to appeal to Pakistan's friends in Iran and the Arabian Peninsula to stop at source any financing of those activities. Secondly, and this is an internal matter for Pakistan, to effectively seal the entry into Fatah so that the Punjabi militants that are fueling that that fight and that are training the Taliban and other militants in advanced warfare against the Pakistani state can be controlled. And, of course, the most important one coming after the Mumbai attacks is to somehow de-weaponize those Punjabi militant groups in central and southern Punjab. Because till you do that, you will always have this risk. You have to remember that in 2008, there were over 60 suicide bombings in Pakistan. And in 2007, there were about 60, 57 to 60, depending on how you count them. And in 2007, something like 36 of them were against the military. And so these are the people that have trained the terrorists to use suicide bombing against the Pakistani state. So you have to control them internally. That was a much broader issue. So, you know, we were trying to get the report as briefly as possible, but you can see that it wasn't as brief as we wanted it to be.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Shuja. My question is sort of just general. It seems to me I would have liked to see an integrated recommendation of the Pakistan government and the military. It seems to me that that is central to the progress in the future. The second thing is I feel the role of India is very important, and while you mentioned the difficulties, I think it should not be not included in such a report.
Thank you, Ahmed. Again, this was one of those broader issues that we only referred to in some of our discussion. When you see the report in detail, you'll see that the conflict with India or the threat of conflict with India still informs the Pakistan Army and still informs a lot of the political discussion within the country. And so that really remains the key element, that once that conflict is removed from the scene, you have all kinds of things opening up, including the point that Arno made, which is instead of 16 cents to the dollar available for development, you may have 40 or 50 cents to the dollar available for development, instead of currently where you have reportedly something like 40 cents going to the armed forces and the rest primarily going to debt servicing. So the India-Pakistan solution would open up all these possibilities. And for that, not just the Indian and Pakistani government, but the people of India and Pakistan need to push their governments in that direction.
And surely the final settlement in Afghanistan, if one comes, will obviously have to be part, India will have to be part of the solution. That brings us to the end of this afternoon session on federally administered tribal areas in Pakistan, and I think we owe a big debt of gratitude to our two experts.